From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This weekend marks the anniversary of NASDAQ's record high when the technology heavy stock index hit 5,048.62 before crashing back to earth. Cast your mind back to a time before you knew the term market cap, before Chris Matthews burrowed under your skin like a telechigger, before NBC was a suffix. I refer to the period that should be known as BCNBC, before the proliferation of financial news coverage on cable.
CNBC, CNN-FN, Fox News Channel, MSNBC, each has invested untold millions of dollars and huge chunks of their schedules to bring you the very latest from that wildly bucking rodeo bull called Wall Street. But then the irrational exuberance finally gave out. When investors began to have all sorts of demands for the companies they owned holdings in, pie-in-the-sky expectations such as profitability, it was like the bulls hit a dead end in Pamplona, first for tech stocks, then for the broader market, then for the cable shows that followed them.
If you put a graph of what's happened on the stock market and laid a graph of the ratings of these shows on top of it, they would pretty much track.
Kyle Pope is the TV editor of Inside.com.
Carnage is great, and really dramatic declines or extremely excruciating wipeouts of companies where, you know, you get bankruptcies or huge layoffs or CEOs leaving, that's good for ratings on television, and people will tune in to watch that. But when you get this sort of slow drip bleed day after day after day, that's where you get into trouble.
Trouble there is. Ratings for the financial networks, with the possible exception of CNBC, have fallen sharply. And the best thing you can say about CNBC is that its explosive growth has stopped cold. The consequence has been a lot of activity to regain audience growth. CNBC has begun broadcasting golf for its upscale male audience at hours hitherto reserved for markets minutiae. CNN-FN has canceled some underperforming shows, such as Digital Jam, and according to CNN financial editor Myron Kandel, is restaging its entire network in a less stocks-centric format called CNN Money.
To reflect the fact that we're going to do more emphasis on personal finance, on other aspects of investment, not only the stock market, and we're going to get down in the trenches, so to speak, with where people really invest their money, what they care about, and how they can best manage their finances.
Fuzzing the issue of declining viewership is the vast audience of the uncounted, traveling business people in hotel rooms and untraveling business people in their own offices, where the TV perpetually tuned to CNN-FN or CNBC has never been measured in the ratings. If the lower numbers of home viewers are attributable to dilettante day traders who got crushed by the retreating bulls, or to more disinterested observers who followed the bull market as a spectator sport and are now tuning elsewhere instead, the actual decline may not be as significant as meets the eye. Nonetheless, the networks now have to face some tough questions, such as, is the current predicament partly a crisis of their own making? Inside.com's Kyle Pope.
There was a certain boosterism to the tone of the coverage, both on all these networks. And there was a sense of there's something great going on. There's sort of a wild ride.
And with every shattering of the NASDAQ's previous high, a celebratory carnival air to the coverage.
Okay, I mean, I guess I'll buy that.
Bruno Cohen is vice president for business programming at CNBC.
We're certainly using those numerical benchmarks as an opportunity to say, boy, this is extraordinary what it is that's going on. Celebratory is your term, but we're not underplaying the significance of those as market benchmarks and maybe, I suppose, as benchmarks that indicate investor sentiment.
But how high could we go? What, you know, with the momentum that we are talking about here, where could you see the NASDAQ going?
For now, it seems like you want to be on the long side of technology. It looks like we're part of a long-term advance here. And I think if you get that part of the equation right, that's where you're going to see the best gains.
Mike, thanks. Have a good weekend.
Cohen, however, by no means buys the charge that CNBC hyped the market. He says that networks frequently asked pointed questions about astronomical valuations of publicly traded companies. But as CNN's Myron Kandel says, hyperbole happens.
We try to not to appear to be cheerleading the market. We want to be dispassionate, objective observers. We are human, however, and I'm sure can't remember an example to give you, but I'm sure we made a mistake now and then.
The upshot is that some viewers, either accustomed to boosterism or simply fearful of dispassionate reporting's effect on the markets, view unboosterish coverage as irresponsible. Bruno Cohen of CNBC.
Last year, very influential market commentator Abby Joseph Cohen changed her recommended allocation for how much of your portfolio ought to be in stocks and how much should be in bonds, and she reduced, I think, by 5% the allocation that she recommended for being in securities, and it had an impact on the market, or appeared to. And we were reporting that story pretty prominently and reprising it and getting other reaction to it. And I remember getting a letter from a viewer, a woman who had taken a lot of her IRA money and put it into high-tech stocks and couldn't understand why we would, in her view, publicize these statements by Abby Joseph Cohen. Why not just ignore it? Because what we were doing was forcing the market down.
Nobody blamed the messenger when the NASDAQ was at 5,000. But for investors and broadcasters alike, it's live by the market, die by the market. And such commentators as Kyle Pope believe at least one network will succumb to mauling by the bears. Conventional wisdom says the advantage in the financial news shakeout will go to programming like CNBC's Squawk Box, which relies as much on the quirky mix of talent as on the content itself. But there's more conventional wisdom that may apply in yet one more livestock metaphor. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and a bad market is what it is. For years, the raison d'etre of cable financial news was to tune in and profit by what you learn. The proposition, stay tuned and cut your losses, doesn't have quite the same ring.
What the American press does not cover is every bit as important as what it does cover. And what it hasn't covered, says reporter Greg Pallast, is the theft of the presidential election in the state of Florida. Now, Pallast is a U.S. citizen who has done a great deal of investigative work on this subject, and it's gotten front page treatment on the country's leading paper, but not his country. It was the lead in Britain's Guardian newspaper and warranted a hefty 14-minute story on Britain's BBC. Greg Pallast, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Brooke.
Now, first, could you summarize your findings for us?
Well, what I found was that the state of Florida, Catherine Harris's office, under the direction of Governor Jeb Bush, ordered the removal of 64,000 names they used a computer system to find 64,000 people who were supposedly felons. About half of these people were African American, but almost none of them were felons. So you had several thousand people, probably tens of thousands of people, barred from voting in the November election.
And mostly Democrats.
Mostly Democrats. Those are Al's votes.
Okay, so you say that with the exception of the Orlando Sentinel and C-SPAN, no other news organization, at least no major ones, did any work on this story?
No work. I mean, I got a lot of praise and comment from Washington Post, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, et cetera, from their columnists, and they repeated the allegations from BBC and The Guardian, which is a major newspaper here in Britain. Yet there was no follow-up on the news pages, no comment, no reflection, nothing in the American media, despite the thousands of reporters kind of milling around looking at each other in Florida.
I have a piece from January 11th from USA Today that addresses the question of voter fraud and specifically the exclusion of African Americans from the rolls, but doesn't answer the question. Is that your main complaint, that no one nailed it down?
Well, it's not like the information wasn't around before the election. So I'm a little bit stunned at my fellow reporters for not questioning what was happening in Florida beforehand. Florida was the only state to use a private corporation, and this private corporation was Republican Party connected, to use a private corporation to go through voter rolls and suggest names to be purged from voter rolls. That's pretty serious stuff. That information was available before the election.
Now, this organization is called Database Technology?
Database Technologies, which was paid $4 million, several times what companies are normally paid for this type of work, to use computers to hunt down supposed felons. The company told us that they were told by the state of Florida to provide more names than could actually be verified. Now, they were paid to actually verify whether these people were in fact felons, but in fact they didn't go through with any verification process, and they were told they didn't have to by the state, according to the company. So I'm not blaming DBT per se, but certainly the state of Florida I'm blaming. I should say that I took a BBC camera crew in to talk to the Department of Elections, and the head of the Department of Elections under Catherine Harris, a guy named Clay Roberts, he just literally ripped off the microphone and ran away from the cameras yelling, "Stop the cameras," when we asked him about the contracts. What's interesting is that I was the first television reporter to ask the question, did you systematically remove these names, and did you pay this company to give you a bunch of names that you knew and that they told you would contain many people who had the right to vote? My problem is, how come I was the first reporter to ask? My cameras didn't show up until this month. We had like CBS, at least they began to pick up the story. They'd talked to me and gotten names and phone numbers, et cetera. But as soon as they got a stone-cold denial from Jeb Bush's office, it was investigation closed. That's the entire nature of investigative reporting in America, unfortunately.
Why do you think the proud tradition of investigative reporting in the United States has come to this pass?
You know, when you have a for-profit, multi-billion-dollar corporation, they don't take on risks. They don't take on costs.
How important an issue do you think the threat of lawsuits is on investigative journalism?
We have the wonderful privilege of a First Amendment in the U.S., which we don't have anywhere else in the world, certainly don't have it in Britain. What's missing in the U.S., frankly, is more courage. Once the governor of Florida says, "I did nothing, these allegations are baloney," to them, that's it, story closed. NAACP alleges, the official says that's baloney, and then Ted Koppel asks a couple of people some questions. Good night, see you tomorrow. You get your 90-second reports on the CBS Evening News. That's it. That's American news.
Well, Greg Palast, thank you very much.
Sorry if I sound a little bitter, but, you know, the American style of news has forced me into exile with my family until things change.
Well, thanks again.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, the awful truth about local TV news. We like it awful. And we learn how to make an anchor float.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The February sweeps have ended, and with them the rankest putrescence in the already fetid swamp known as local TV news. In the journalistic, academic, and public broadcasting communities, the state of local news is regarded as a sorry one indeed. Mike Pesca, On the Media's producer at large, has these observations.
If it bleeds, it leads.
A jumbo jet bursts into flames shortly after takeoff. At least 70 people are killed. Good evening.
Live shots during a hurricane. Hidden cameras. Salad bar sting operations. Happy talk.
I had to give up my nap today so I can hand out candy to the kid.
They started early today.
Yeah, they did.
So nice outside.
Infrared motel room microbes. Deadly children's toys.
And the psycho saw, get this one, was one of the items cited.
A report on public toilets you won't want to miss. And tortured segues to the weatherman that make the Jerry Lewis telethon seem as if scripted by Shakespeare himself.
$60 to pay the fine, another $30 for a late fee. Question is whether we should fine Steve Baskerville for what is going to happen this weekend.
Local news is the disease. is the Columbia School of Journalism the cure?
Welcome to all of you and to our discussion about local television news. That's really going to be our focus for the next hour or and a half.
To be fair, people within the media have been fighting the good fight against hype, chit-chat, and luridness for years. To be unfair, their feebleness just might shock you. Legions of academics and committees of concerned journalists, including an outfit called the Committee of Concerned Journalists, would like to bring back to TV news the values embodied in men like Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. You know, Murrow, whose person-to-person pioneered the celebrity chat show. Cronkite, who once lit up a cigarette on the air and said, "Winston tastes good like a cigarette should." That sentiment, commercialism, and grammar could never exist on TV today. But what does exist is a viewing public which, according to Deborah Potter, finds local news
boring. It's predictable, and many of them think it's largely irrelevant.
Potter is the executive director of NewsLab, a nonprofit organization that works with local TV stations. Her conversations with news viewers played well with the Columbia crowd, yet they're not backed up by evidence. A recent study by the Pew Center for People and the Press shows that 80% of those surveyed said they were satisfied with TV news. Local news ranked behind only CNN as the most believed form of news across all media.
Because it's people you see and you know what's going on in your community, you trust it.
Chicago's Midway Airport was full of fans of local news. People from Washington, Milwaukee, and Orlando sounded less like the audience according to researchers and more like the audience according to stations trying to give the people what they want.
Channel 8 especially is not giving much fluff. They're really down to the point. They give you the facts, and then they try and stay friendly. That was a good thing. They're a very friendly station.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we're just used to the people that are on it, and they seem to give you all the news.
People are looking for their local news to just kind of give them the bullet points of what's going on. Short, sweet, here's your information. People don't have a lot of time.
I think hammering home time after time about violence and the macabre side of life, it really sets a poor tone. When in reality, there are many better things going on within our communities that can be focused on.
Even that last man said his complaint was true only of the stations he didn't watch. He liked Tampa's WTSP because
I think it's fair and it's balanced and it's reporting and its style.
That's the kind of endorsement a local TV station would kill for. And then they'd probably lead with the murder. For a time, Chicago was the epicenter of the argument over local news. About a year ago, CBS-owned WBBM brought in Carol Marine to anchor a serious newscast. Her attempt to reverse the sizzle-to-steak ratio caught the attention of such programs as On the Media and The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer.
WBBM recently introduced an innovative new broadcast that is radical in its simplicity. It emphasizes news, not gimmicks, news.
News dragged WBBM's already moribund ratings into the sub-basement. The plug was quickly pulled.
Ponderous, not enough movement, not enough excitement, not enough graphics, basically kind of dull, and has been said by several people it was PBS on CBS.
Tim Jones is the media writer for the Chicago Tribune. He and everyone who still believes in quality local news are quick to point out that Marine's demise shouldn't dissuade other TV stations from trying. But if you're a news director who wants to go highbrow, before you knock on the skeptical station boss's door, you'd better be prepared to answer for the Marine experiment. And what do you say to that? Maybe something like,
quality in local television sells. And by sells, I mean gets ratings. And we don't necessarily think winning in the ratings is a bad thing.
Carl Gottlieb is the deputy director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He heads up their local news project, which annually records 2 weeks of newscasts at dozens of stations. The tapes are watched by experts who assign points for things like local relevance, balance, and sourcing. The newscasts are eventually given an overall letter grade. When the grades came out, Boston's WBZ proudly proclaimed themselves the top-ranked news in town.
When news breaks, it's not just that we get there fast. We take the time to check the facts, to tell you the full story.
Integrity counts. When it comes to breaking news, we're fast.
WBZ neglected to say that their grade was only a C. Only 6 stations out of 49 earned A's. What's more, according to Gottlieb, the A's of today might not have been at the head of the class 10 years ago.
This is based on a curve. These are the best of what's out there. But I will say, after looking at a lot of these myself, maybe too many. There's some pretty good broadcasts out there.
The project's thousands of research hours yielded the conclusion that quality begets ratings. The reaction? It was derided and then ignored. This in an industry desperately throwing money at consultants for a tenth of a ratings point bump. The project's findings weren't persuasive because they consist of arguable analyses hinged on subjective surveys. Local news directors don't want that. They get minute-by-minute Nielsen breakdowns that show them the exact points when viewers tune in and out. They know who's getting high ratings and what they're doing to get them. Why should they trust letter grades? They'd rather put their faith in the powers of a man like Joel Cheatwood. In Miami, Cheatwood made his name by using flashy crime coverage to build WSVN into the town's dominant station. In Boston, he brought WHDH out of the basement. In Chicago, he made Jerry Springer a commentator, which caused Carol Marine to quit the first time. By the time she left again, Cheatwood was the man in charge of all CBS stations. Journalism standard bearers like Carl Gottlieb may bestow the letter grades. Network bosses like Joel Cheatwood deliver the ratings. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Joel Cheatwood is vice president of news for all CBS stations. Mr. Cheatwood, is there a difference between what people say they want and what they really want?
I think to some degree, sure. It's when you look at research about news content and see that everybody wanted to see stories on the environment and on education, and yet station after station would program to that end and nobody would watch.
Well, Mr. Cheatwood, you've caused the ratings to soar at station after station, and you've done it in ways at various times that may very well have been misconstrued and certainly criticized, but it's worked. So what have you done that's worked?
Well, let's take Boston, for example. It was clear that really that the market had kind of been on autopilot. We went in and really determined that an aggressive news approach where we really covered major stories wherever they took place, as long as they had a New England connection, we would travel, we would cover them. The O.J. Simpson trial was going on. We felt it had high interest. We weren't comfortable with just having our network provide us with coverage. We had a reporter there for 2 months. We identified that there was a real need for health reporting in the market and consumer investigative reporting. And really those three elements, I think, help the station rise to where it is today.
You gave them more OJ, you gave them more health coverage, and you gave them more consumer coverage. It sounds like there's a certain amount of carrot and stick happening there.
No, I don't think there is, but I also think that there are ways to present those stories that most people would look at and say that's not a TV story. I will tend to put a touch to things or a spin to things that make them aesthetically more attractive to watch.
The Project for Excellence in Journalism came out with a massive study, thousands of hours spent watching local newscasts. And in a nutshell, it said that quality news begets higher ratings. Did this survey cause any ripples within the stations?
You know, I don't always agree with the criteria that goes into the sorts of rating systems like that one. But I do think that it's important because it provokes question and discussion. We need to take a hard look at crime reporting. We can't just use the old standard of, you know, if a siren is blasting or a red light is flashing, we're going to put a camera to it.
If it bleeds, it leads. Is it true?
You know, I'll tell you, more so than ever, it's not true. The best thing that local television news does is provide up-to-the-minute coverage of breaking news stories. But what's happened is we've kind of become the one-trick pony. We do it well, we provide it, people respond to it, so we've overdosed on it. People have said, look, enough is enough. You know, the shtick doesn't really work for us anymore. It's old hat. So give us some substance.
Isn't if it bleeds, it leads the way that you made your name?
I think when that criticism was attached, it was in Miami. It was a time in that city's makeup where crime was the number one concern among the citizenry. You know, when I'm asked to defend myself, I always point out that during the time at that station, we increased the level of investigative reporting, education reporting, and health reporting to a greater extent than anyone had ever done. But again, we chose to present it in a flashier style, I think, overall than local television had been accustomed to. So people gravitated to the glitzier elements of the presentation. The critics forgot about the substance that was there.
Is there a siege mentality out there among the stations that, of course, J schools and media pundits are going to criticize them, and those people just don't understand the bottom line?
There is a certain sense of idealism when it comes to this business. This is a business. We are accountable to budgets. We're accountable to profit-making companies. You know, the days of news divisions being loss leaders, they're over.
Joel Cheatwood is Vice President of News for all CBS stations.
On a recent Saturday, a dozen people gathered at the Reuters Bureau in Washington for a day-long session on how to be a news anchor. Participants paid $575 each to learn the finer points of the profession, such as makeup application, suit selection, reading from a teleprompter, as well as mastering the head turn, script shuffle, anchor toss, and fake ad lib. We sent Amy Dickinson to weigh the aspiring anchors.
All news anchors have to do is sit still, read their copy, and look good around the head and shoulders. They don't even have to wear pants. This is why everyone wants to be an anchor. It seems like an easy, pantless job. Anchors are always tacking extra titles onto their job descriptions, like managing editor, but really it's just reading into a camera. Unfortunately, reading, in fact, doing anything at all, turns out to be a tall order when you're doing it from behind the anchor desk.
We have a hot studio at 10 o'clock, and during the morning what we're going to do is put you on the set and co-anchor. You've got the script in front of you.
Herb Brubaker, a former producer at NBC who runs the anchor school, takes the participants onto a set to anchor a fictitious local newscast. Their performance is evaluated, and at the day's end, they have a professional-looking tape of themselves being an anchor, or at least playing one on TV. Only half of the anchors in training already work in the news business, mostly for small cable stations. There's also a lawyer from New York, a PR woman from Pennsylvania, and this woman, Suzanne Goldklang.
Platinum bezel set tennis bracelet. It's very hard to find platinum tennis bracelets anywhere.
That's Suzanne, and her old job as host of the Value Vision Shopping Network in Minneapolis. She's here to see if she can peddle the news as well as she once pushed limited edition porcelain figurines. On the set, a generic slide of the U.S. Capitol helps locate the fake newscast in Washington. There are three cameras, two teleprompters, a stage manager and director, as well as Nathan Roberts, hired for the day to be permanent co-anchor for the class. The atmosphere is tense and excited, like the casting call from A Chorus Line.
Again, step, kick.
Giant pandas, Mei Ching, and Chang Chan are resting comfortably at their new home, the National Zoo.
It's vehicular, by the way, folks.
Right. That connects with turn.
A judge has acquitted a Naval Academy midshipman.
A 5, 6, 7.
Hi.
I'm sorry.
Mistakes have a way of being magnified on camera. So do quirks. Anchor wannabe Joe Hamilton has learned from looking at his tape that his left eyebrow has a life of its own.
They definitely told me a bunch of things, like I said, about my eyebrow. Didn't even realize about that.
Have like an eyebrow issue.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I think it's like on certain words when I stress them, it's just so I remember to stress them.
I feel uncomfortable.
Gary Casimir suffers from wardrobe distress.
The ties are coming up, it's bulking up on the set, and I can see the monitor, I can see the coat. So I'm conscious of that, and I'm trying to fix my coat. And I think that came out often. You're trying to fix things while you're on the air, and you're not supposed to be fidgeting like that. And that comes off, especially when you're delivering the news. Every little thing, including just the way your eyes look at the teleprompter, telegraph so much to the audience.
There are other distractions, such as looking into the wrong camera, staticky hair, or flop sweat. The students at Anchor School haven't exactly displayed the qualities that would make a viewer, even their mom, want to watch their newscast. It's enough to cast a pall over the once giddy atmosphere.
Good evening. I'm Mark Rotherham.
And I'm Nathan
Mark Rotheringham, a 39-year-old pharmaceutical salesman who has no broadcasting experience, takes his place beside Nathan Roberts at the anchor desk. Rotheringham, who resembles Clark Kent, lives in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and is contemplating a career change.
Stealing the spotlight.
That's right, Nathan. After making a 17-hour journey followed by millions around the world, giant pandas Mei Xiang and Chen Chen are resting comfortably at their new home, the National Zoo.
Rotheringham hits every beat in the fake newscast. He shuffles his papers like Jennings, delivers his copy with Brokaw-like earnestness, and ad-libs better than Rather. Rotheringham, whose all-time favorite TV character is Ted Baxter, the anchorman from The Mary Tyler Moore Show, says he learned from hours spent in the studio watching everyone else's mistakes.
It really was nerve-wracking, and I don't know, from what everybody told me, I guess it didn't look that way. I was really nervous, so I'm glad it worked. I'm glad it went well.
Are you interested in being in the news business, or are you more interested in just being an anchor?
I'm interested in learning as much as I can about the business, and what I'm planning to do is to talk to Herb, since I haven't been actually in this business, to find out what kind of a market that I should start in. Should I start as a reporter? Because I'm certainly willing to, you know, work my way up and learn the business.
Most of today's anchor school graduates will return to their hometowns with a dream of peddling their audition tapes into a weekend fill-in slot at their local cable station. The best possible outcome is a steady gig in a very small market. There they can learn on the job, sparing the national audience the agony of watching them try.
As the election standoff continues, both sides are planning for tomorrow's oral arguments. I'm sorry.
Well, hold it up. You jumped your cue. That's not
okay,
your,
rewrite. Let's take it again.
For On the Media, I'm Amy Dickinson.
We'd like to know what you think about your local TV news. Actually, each week on our website at onthemedia.org, we provide a forum for your thoughts and comments on our big idea that week. And this week, we want your reactions to Mike Pesca's observations on local news and the comments of Joel Cheatwood. Log on to onthemedia.org, that's On the Media one word, and look for the heading The Big Idea and click on comments. You can also listen to this week's show and past programs, comment on any of the pieces we run, get free transcripts, and find all sorts of interesting extras, including, of course, links to sites related to the stories we cover, all at onthemedia.org. Coming up, when good weathermen go wrong, and why reporters get punched in Hollywood movies.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. All the conditions were right. A huge storm moving northeast with lots of moist Gulf air. A vast front of Arctic cold moving south. All to meet on the eastern seaboard, combining hurricane force winds with 2 feet of snow. It was going to be a blizzard of historic proportions from Boston to Washington, D.C. But despite nearly a week of hysterical warnings on TV news, it really didn't turn out that way. The blizzard of '01 for the major cities of the East Coast was a dusting. One place where this storm did hit, however, was Albany, New York, where meteorologist Howie Altschul nailed his forecast. He joins us now to speculate about how his big city colleagues failed to nail theirs. Mr. Outchell, lay some meteorology on us.
Well, what was supposed to happen is this storm was supposed to move exactly along the perfect path that would be far enough east to keep all the precipitation snow. But as is the case so often, the storms don't exactly go the way we initially think. And therefore, the forecast did not pan out for a big blizzard as it was hyped up to be. Rather, it turned to rain for much of the day and then a little bit of snow afterward.
If the conditions suggest, according to the computer models, the possibility of a storm of historical significance, what responsibility do meteorologists have to give us some sort of advance warning, and what should be the nature of that kind of warning?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with starting to mention what the potential could be as far as strong gusty winds, very heavy snowfall in excess of 6 inches or something, if that's what you think is going to happen, going to predict 1 to 3 feet of snow, as some stations did 4 days before the event started or 3 days before the event started, is a little bit extreme, in my opinion.
Does your audience spike in the advance of a big storm?
Well, I think that's only natural. I think the bigger the situation, the more people are going to tune in and want to see what's happening.
Do you see a trend of overhyping, of Chicken Little constantly saying the sky is going to fall?
Yes, I do.
And what do you suppose is the reason for this?
It could be a number of reasons. It could be giving the viewer what they want. It could be also along the same lines. It could be to boost ratings. Most meteorologists know that you have to be careful and try not to blow things out of proportion. And I hope most stations would keep that in mind and not sensationalize things too much.
Well, did you happen to see any of the coverage from Washington to New York City to Boston?
But look at the duration of this from Sunday afternoon all the way until Tuesday morning, a 36-hour period of punishing winds along the coast and heavy snowfall, especially inland. Once again, we present to you Eyewitness to Winter Storms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Yes, I saw on Friday night one of the networks start talking about a blizzard of historic proportions, 1 to 3 feet in the mid-Atlantic, 75-mile-an-hour winds, hurricane-force winds, flooding, the storm of the century, even though the century is only a couple months old, so to speak. I got their drift that there was going to be some huge storm. And if I were not a meteorologist and the general public, I think I would start being concerned if I didn't know about weather and what really would happen.
Well, I can tell you that here in Washington, people were concerned after 4 or 5 days of hearing about the blizzard of '01. The supermarket shelves were bare. The whole region was in a panic. The coverage was absolutely hysterical. Have you ever seen this kind of local news coverage where 4 or 5 days in advance of a storm, they're already telling people to gird for the worst?
Well, you know, I can't say that I've seen that type of definitiveness, like a hurricane, for instance, coming our way. You know, they always have some sort of rationalization. Say if it stays on the same track, hurricane watches or hurricane warnings will be put into effect for Miami. So monitor the situation. I think they should have taken that approach with this situation as well. But it seemed like there was a little more hype because the computer models were forecasting the same thing consistently day after day. So I would say that the coverage was a little too extreme and that the viewers took it to heart and really prepared for the worst.
So if you're a news director, when do you trot out the blizzard of '01 graphic and that special voiceover guy with the unbelievably deep voice?
I couldn't answer for a news director, I think, because I'm trying to be so responsible as a meteorologist and do a good job that I may have different opinions than some other news directors around the country.
Are you at loggerheads with your own management over how much to hype a weather story?
Sometimes it could get to that point. If there's a very small amount, you know, of snow and they want a meteorologist to go and go into the field and do some live reporting, you know, it's 1 or 2 inches of snow in your area. What's the big deal? Unless it's Texas, of course, or southern Florida, then that would be a big deal. But here in Albany, it's wintertime. We expect these things.
And I'm just curious, what did happen in Albany? Did you get socked?
Well, yeah, luckily our forecast was perfect.
And we're talking at least a few inches the way I see it right now. We'll fine-tune that during the course of the weekend. Scattered snow showers tonight, maybe an inch or so, not very heavy snowfall at
all. Feeling pretty pleased with yourself Monday afternoon, were you?
Oh, yeah. With all the hype, and once I heard all the flack that all the other meteorologists were taking, or other weather people, I should say, down south, I think I was pretty happy with our forecast, because it was such a serious storm situation, and the computer models were all over the place, and I made the right call.
Howie Altschul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Howie Altschul is the meteorologist for WNYT in Albany, New York.
If the big screen is anything to go by, Hollywood hates the media, especially the news media. Increasingly, the movies tell us that the media pander, incite violence, and degrade the people who produce it as much as the people who consume it. That was true as early as Citizen Kane, Orson Welles' memorable portrayal of William Randolph Hearst.
If the headline is big enough, it makes the news big enough.
That's right, Mr.
Now, the murder of this Mrs. Harry Silverstone.
There's no proof that that woman was murdered,
no
or
proof,
even that she's dead.
Because she's missing, and the neighbors are getting suspicious.
It's not our function to report the gossip of housewives. If we were interested in that kind of thing, Mr. Kane, we could fill the paper twice over daily.
Mr. Carter, that's the kind of thing we are going to be interested in from now on.
But Hollywood seems to reserve particular revulsion for television news. You can see it in countless films like Network and Natural Born Killers, and in Robert De Niro's latest film, 15 Minutes, which opened this weekend. It's about two fame-hungry murderers and the TV cameras that love them. David Edelstein is the movie critic for Slate.com. He says that when you take in a Hollywood movie that slams reporters, you should consider the source.
Well, you have to understand, the people who make movies are celebrities and millionaires who jealously guard their privacy, and they have a real interest in demonizing the media that seeks to expose their workings. Almost every movie that you see nowadays that portrays the press, the press is meddlesome, the enemy of truth, the distorter of truth. The first two Die Hard films, these movies always climax with, in this case, not the hero, but the hero's wife punching out the reporter, who in his unsavory and unscrupulous zest to cover the story has somehow endangered the hero.
Mr. McClain, now that it's all over after this incredible ordeal, what are your feelings?
These days, what you see is a hero or heroine who just wants to be allowed to nail the bad guys, and these horrible, unscrupulous reporters are coming in and endangering the public welfare.
What about the obsession with not just intrusiveness and obstruction, but with lurid sensationalism, which the movies frequently suggest the press incites and feeds on? Let us go back to Network.
I watched your 6 o'clock news today. It's straight tabloid. That you had a minute and a half of that lady riding a bike naked in Central Park. On the other hand, you had less than a minute of hard national and international news. It was all sex, scandal, brutal crime, sports, children with incurable diseases, and lost puppies. So I don't think I'll listen to any protestations of high standards of journalism. Now, you're right down in the street soliciting audiences like the rest of us. Look, all I'm saying is, if you're going to hustle, at least do it right.
This is a question of encouraging somebody to go crazy on the air in order to build ratings.
This is an old complaint that we've been hearing for decades, which is that somehow or other the media inspires violence and rewards violence. A very good case in point is the new film 15 Minutes, which I think is an atrocity on so many levels, in which the villains are this kind of fabulous construct. I mean, they're pure evil. They are two Eastern European tourists who seem to have risen up from the black muck of communism. They're infected by this American capitalist dream of wealth and celebrity. And so they go around killing people and filming the murders.
And the news media, personified by Kelsey Grammer, gets enlisted.
Hey, Top Story, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Look, it doesn't work that way.
If you don't want my film, I'll call another show, and they will show it.
All right, I'll meet you. I need two things from you. I want exclusivity, and you will surrender to me.
Bring cash.
Kelsey Grammer is willing, although he identifies himself as a friend of a particular character, when that character is murdered, he thinks nothing of paying $1 million for the exclusive rights to air this atrocity footage on live TV. Now, this is a movie that has absolutely no bones about showing you the blood-drenched, semi-nude body of a prostitute who has been butchered. I mean, so what you have is a lurid tabloid movie trying to score points by denouncing lurid tabloids, which is the oldest trick in the world.
You have Natural Born Killers and Mad City and now 15 Minutes. They all suggest that bad things wouldn't happen if the news weren't out there so hungry for them.
Obviously, there is an enormous hunger for celebrity. But, you know, before we blame the press for this, we have to ask what it is in this culture that has created this void in people whereby they don't feel they exist unless they can see themselves larger than life. And that, I don't think, is the press's fault. In that regard, I think the press is following the dictates of capitalism, which wants to sell things to people.
David Edelstein reviews movies for Slate.com. This week, another film with an ominous media message hit the screen. Its target is reality television, and its premise is a game in which people chosen at random are given weapons and sent to hunt and kill each other. The winner is the one who survives. The film is shot completely on video, like Cops, with the same quick cuts and percussive soundtrack, a chilling and mordantly funny depiction of extreme reality TV called Series 7.
They're chosen at random.
Is your dad home?
Get away from me. I mean it.
They're given weapons.
I'm not an aggressive person.
And they're forced to play. Now.
Tell her to come in for a snack and a cup of coffee and blow my head off and let's get this show on the road.
We're going away.
Joining me now is writer-director Daniel Minahan. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Let me read you a line of a review from one critic, Andrew O'Hare, and see what you think. He writes, Series 7 is a painstaking, often brilliantly executed imitation of unwatchable crap.
Series 7 isn't for everyone, and this is really a film that implicates you. Some people think that Connie, the nurse, is the villain of the film who goes around killing everyone, but really the villain of the film is the audience and the world that allows this to happen.
Is this a denunciation?
You know, people keep trying to get me to say that reality TV is a bad thing. I think this film is very critical, but I'd be a hypocrite to say that reality TV is a bad thing because I really like to watch.
When you were putting this film together, you had never even heard of Survivor. Of course, now the parallels are being drawn between Series 7 and Survivor all the time.
I just try to imagine the most horrible, high-stakes, insidious TV game show that I possibly could, and Survivor kind of scooped us.
But what you created in Series 7 is a movie that when you watch it, the stakes are upped to the point where you can't go any higher. In fact, the impact, at least on me, was almost deadening. It was almost assaultive. The world that you built couldn't have valued life less, couldn't have valued personal relationships less. Everything was belittled by the format in which you presented it.
Thank you. I tried to push it as far as I possibly could to make my point. I mean, I think a good satire really does that.
What's wrong with reality television?
It's mean-spirited, these competitive shows. They're antisocial. They're based on hatred and exclusion. And that's the fun of it. I'm working to try and get Series 8, the sequel, on TV as a limited series.
Where it could very easily be confused with the real thing.
That's very exciting to me. Yeah. I like the idea of imagining someone channel surfing and stumbling upon it.
And what feelings would you want it to inspire besides excitement?
Horror, disgust, anger, fascination.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Daniel Minahan is the writer and director of Series 7.
With the Writers Guild strike looming, the television networks are scrambling to produce shows for the fall that don't require scripts. Think reality television. Think an easy target for satire. Modern humorist's Alexandra Ringe cooked up this report.
Recently, NBC experimented with an unscripted version of Friends. The actors who play the Friends were asked to spend the day engaged in a group activity they felt their characters would enjoy. they chose watching themselves on TV. That was last week. Now, rather than retooling existing programs, the networks are developing new shows. Leslie Moonves, president of CBS, explains that unscripted reality shows are where the money's at.
Hey, who needs writers? Survivor makes its own words. The early show with Brian Gumbel makes its own words about Survivor. Hey, that's what my pal Fidel called Beauty in a Box.
Survivor creator Mark Burnett is producing Why Me for CBS, a series of mini-documentaries that contrast his success with the failures of other men named Mark Burnett. NBC, in its bid to cope with the loss of writers, has lined up yet another one-hour program created by Dick Wolf, whose trademark is stories ripped from the day's headlines. The new show, Law and Order Raw, goes one step further. Each episode will feature Wolf actually reading aloud from the paper.
Tax cut, faith-based, campaign finance. Oh, honey, look, there was a double murder in Staten Island. Isn't that awful? Pass me the scissors. No, the good scissors.
On Fox, David E. Kelly throws one of his many hats into the reality ring with Ally About You, a fashion makeover show for women lawyers.
Shorter. Shorter. Oh, how about shorter?
Finally, ABC's executives, having lost David E. Kelly to Fox, are planning reality programming based on their own lives. Watch for Market Research, Bloopers and Blunders, and Who Wants to Reschedule Millionaire?
That's it for this week's show. And by the way, that last story was a joke. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Kathy Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk and the Keefe brothers, John and Dylan. Also, Max Robbins, Jewel Gardner, Betsy Gardella, and Rex Doan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It was a joke.
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.